Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja, and I've obviously been imbibing too much here since I can't speak properly, but it's all good. Welcoming Nathan back. Nathan, how you doing?
Doing well.
And we've got Rachel Bartleball, Nathan's sister, joining us again. Rachel, how are you?
I'm doing very well.
And no, we are not talking about a fifth Steven Spielberg.
Sondheim.
I feel out of place. I'm like, I shouldn't be here.
Steven Spielberg. We just wrapped up the last of the Spielberg series. Part four.
That's right. So, no, this is actually our weekly review. We're really excited to be going in and talking about this. We have some drinks, we have some movies, and we have our announcement of the books we're going to be putting out there for your reading pleasure. We're going to be doing our poll to see which book you all would like to read for our discussion. More on that to come later. So first, the drinks. Let's start off with the beer because that was rather disappointing, and I'd rather get to something that was a little bit better. So we tried New Belgium Heavy Watermelon. Rachel, you're not a beer drinker, so I'm going to start with you. Your thoughts on it?
I am not a beer drinker. Actually, I can't usually take more than a few sips. With this one, it's light enough for me that I could – I drank several sips of it. There is nothing spectacular about this beer. I'll just be honest. If I can drink it, it's probably a good sign. It's pretty benign. But very, very faint. When they first poured, they actually poured a little bit out in a cup for me because I can't handle a whole one. But very, very, very faint watermelon on the nose. And then when I tasted it, nothing. And just because I was so focused and really reaching for it, there might have been a little melon in the aftertaste. But
the power of
if
your
I
mind.
Hadn't been like really trying to pull it out, I don't know if it was there. It was underwhelming.
Yeah. I will affirm you. It was there, okay. But only every other sip you took. Nathan, your thoughts?
I'd like to recreate. This is in the previous podcast. We've actually like taken a sip like directly on air. I wish we had done it this time because Nathan pauses and the look of wonderment on his face. He goes, "It tastes like beer."
Exactly like
as if
beer.
He just come to this sad revelation. And you're right. It's just beer.
It was perfect.
There's very little watermelon in this in this fine beverage. You can taste it a little bit. I wonder, I mean, watermelon as a beer flavor doesn't really work out for me. The one that you had recommended.
Terrapin Watermelon Goza.
Yeah. And it had an interesting flavor, but that one I felt like I was drinking cucumber juice.
Yeah.
Like there's not a lot of sweetness to the watermelon, obviously. You're not going to have that with the beer. But this is very, very faint. It's almost like you could have – the drinking game could be, can you spot the watermelon?
Yes.
And it is so faint and fleeting. I mean, it says it's 5% alcohol, but when I poured it, there was a lot of head there and – there wasn't a lot of flavor in it. You're right. It's almost just like beer. Just beer. Yeah. I mean, O'Doul's might be stronger than this.
As a non-drinker, it's drinkable for me, but it is uneventful.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and New Belgium's not necessarily one of the cheaper beer brands.
No.
I mean, it's not Trogs or anything, but this is – it's not worth it.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be better off with a fat tire. I haven't had the tangerine. I saw that. The citrus.
That was decent. Yeah, the citrus IPA.
Okay, that might have been a better choice.
That was a decent one, yeah.
I've come to the conclusion after maybe I need to try more, but I'm not really up for it. If someone out there is listening to this and you've either made or know of a good watermelon beer, let us know because I've not been impressed either with the New Belgium or the Terrapin.
Actually, Heller High Watermelon from 21st Amendment is a decent watermelon.
All right, maybe we'll have to try that next one. New Belgium, you struck out.
Yeah, I agree. You know, to your point, Nathan, that's exactly what I said. I used to make fun of my former boss because whenever he would try beer,
it didn't matter right now.
Even if he is, what's he going to do?
He said former boss.
Whenever he would try beer, it didn't matter what he was trying. His response was always, it's beer. And I would always mock him relentlessly because I could generally – oh, my gosh. I have had too much to drink.
Yeah, I guess it's a little stronger than you thought.
Man. No, it was the whiskey we're going to review afterwards. I've generally could taste the differences, the subtle nuances. It took me two or three sips of this beer, the heavy watermelon, before I could even taste a faint hint.
Yeah, we had drink two apiece, folks, before we knew what was going on.
I know,
on.
Right? I mean, the way I'm talking, could be true. And so, yeah, just very underwhelming. Terrapin, you know, it is a watermelon goza. Yeah, watermelon is hard to replicate. Melon in general is hard to replicate. When
Stick
you're
with a watermelon blow pop.
It, yeah, exactly. When you're infusing it into something, you're going to get very similar flavors. The goza, I think, is a unique enough taste going on, that sweet salty that sour salty characteristic going on, that the watermelon is almost an afterthought, and I'm okay with that in a goza. To me,
yeah, I mean, it's a distinctive beer. I'll give you that. A little too distinctive for my taste, but this is
there's nothing going on. I mean, you might as well, you know, save your money and go out and grab a Corona or, you know, just a lighter summer
fill
beer.
Fill a watermelon with Jim Beam apple.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, well, we're actually, you know, the other thing we tried, Jim Beam apple. And Rachel, we'll start with you because you were actually pretty enthusiastic about that when open.
Yeah, not a beer drinker, but I do like whiskey.
Like, I can't handle a sip of beer.
So I sometimes like some of the Jim Beam flavor ones. They can get pretty sweet. This one is sweet. Not nearly as sweet as the Jim Beam maple. That one will get you. But this is pleasant. I like it. I couldn't sit there. It is sweet enough. I couldn't sit there and sip it like I would like a more aged whiskey.
Speak for yourself.
But it does. I do think it would be a nice mixer. The apple in it has enough of a sour note to it, mm-hmm. instead of just sweet. It's like Nathan said, Jolly Rancher as apple Jolly Rancher, and it is like that. I think especially come fall, mixing it with perhaps some ciders or
you were talking about the Pinnacle caramel.
Yeah, there's like a Pinnacle salted caramel that would make for a very sweet drink, but you'd have like that candied apple. I think Nathan, my brother Nathan, actually made a drink with something like that last year. If you like your fruity and your sweet drinks, it's good. I like it. I think it's good. And we were sitting here sipping it straight, not like mixed with anything. And it's sweet, but it's good.
Lightly sipping it.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, yes.
Except for
well,
Nathan.
Except for me. I was going to say, hence my issue with speaking. And Nathan, your thoughts?
I really like it. We picked up some, Jen and I, back around April. And we actually, at the time, the liquor store that we had gone into, they had someone set up and they were selling something. I could be completely wrong about this, but I think it was Brooks and James or something. And they do a series of like cream like whiskeys.
Yes.
And I think this one might have been a caramel cream whiskey. And we mixed this with the Jim Beam apple. It was fantastic.
Nice.
You and I were just talking about potentially using it for like a sangria or something.
Yeah.
I think it would be amazing. I like the idea of filling a watermelon with it. So
oh, yeah.
Anyone does that, be sure to send the Twitter and Facebook pictures of the watermelon and then what you did
July,
after.
Yes. Here we come.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Rachel, perfect segue. You know, 4th of July weekend, we're, you know, right here. And so Nathan was asking, you know, do I have any recommendations for drinks over 4th of July? Let me just say, we're going to mention two of them. One is beer.
Which tastes just like beer.
That's right. Don't get the heavy melon. Let me say, for 4th of July, you're having friends, family over, it's going to be a general party, get a mix pack. That is my recommendation. When people would come into the store all the time, say, hey, I'm having a variety of people over, what should I get? Get a mix pack of beer. 12 pack is generally what they come in. Usually there's some kind of discount on the case price, which is 24. My typical recommendation, believe it or not, is Sam Adams. Sam Adams makes a great variety of beer in their mix packs that everyone can enjoy.
I like a Sam Adams mix pack.
There you go.
Summer ones are good. Yeah.
The summer ones are good, you know, and usually winter and summer are their two best packs going out
there. The old fizzy wig.
That's right.
Yes. I was going to say the winter ones. Yep. I like those.
Magic Hat does a good one too. A summer collection. I think they're really good.
Yep. So any type of beer that you're into, grab a mix pack of it. Mike's Hard does a mix packs.
Traveler Shandies. One with a pineapple, the grapefruit, and the lemonade, I think.
Oh, cool.
That's excellent. Super good.
Cool. Yep. Line and Kugel has their mix packs out, which, they have all the shandies and stuff in. So my recommendation for 4th of July, go out and grab a mix pack, whether it's a 12 or a case, and just allow people to kind of pick and choose. First of all, you're not going to be left over with a whole ton of beer that you don't want to drink.
Yeah, I got to drag my heavy melons home now.
I know, right? Sucker. So a great sangria really is going to be an awesome 4th of July drink. And it's real easy to make. Most people don't realize, super easy. So what you're going to do is grab a mild red wine. It doesn't matter what it is. Go to your local liquor store and just ask whoever is there that you're trying to make sangria, you want to do it homemade. And they're going to ask if you want to do a red or a white, or hopefully they will. If it's a red wine, you're typically going to want something on the more mild side. If it's a white wine and you want it a little sweeter, a little nicer to drink, grab a Riesling or a Moscato for a white wine. So just ask what the recommendation is.
Some of the barefoot ones work well.
Exactly. Yeah, they're nice and expensive. You can get the 1.5 liters for usually $9 or $10. So yeah, barefoot's perfect.
Sutter Home Moscato is good for a sangria, yep. For a white sangria.
Nathan, who does the Apothic Red?
Apothic Red. I honestly can't remember who the vineyard is, but yeah, Apothic
that
Red.
That one springs to mind as a really good one for sangria, I think.
That's a good one. The only issue with that is usually you're not going to get a 1.5 liter for the reasonable price of mixing
up. Yeah, that's true. It's not going to be – it depends. Sometimes you can get it on sale. It's probably a couple bucks more expensive than the better, but it does make a really nice, like, subtle – sangria.
Yeah, and that's true. It really is good.
If not, Arbor missed it up.
That's right. just look to previous episodes that we did on our review of Arbor Mist. Or if you're trying to make a whole bunch for a ton of people, you know what? Grab a box wine.
I was just going to say.
Yeah, I'm not usually up on box wine.
Fill the kiddie pool.
It's one of the times it's appropriate to buy a box wine is if you're going to make a sangria.
And that's exactly right.
In that
right.
case, you need a lot of fresh fruit.
Yes. So what you're going to do is you're going to grab your wine. That's going to be the base. Then you want to grab a triple sec. Triple sec is going to add more of that peach flavor to it. It's going to up the alcohol in it. And then as we were talking about, the Jim Beam apple is going to be a great addition. I would highly recommend putting that in as well. Then what you want to do is you want to decide how you want the flavorings to go, and you're going to pick up alcohol based on that. So if you want more of a peachy flavor to it, grab a peach tree, DeKuyper peach tree, really inexpensive. It's all over the place, easy to get. So you just want to kind of decide how you want it to go. Cruzan makes several flavored rums that you can grab and put in there. So just decide how you want that fruit flavoring profile to be.
Halls has a good cough syrup.
Robitussin.
Yes.
Then what you're going to do is you're going to go to your grocery store and you're going to pick up all frozen fruit. So you're going to mix all your sangria ingredients together, and then right before you're about to serve it, you're going to dump the frozen fruit in there. That's going to do two things. Instead of dropping ice in there and having it melt and watered down, when the fruit begins to defrost, it's not going to leave a whole bunch of watered down residue, but you're also going to have, it's going to chill your drink, and you're going to have really great fruit flavorings going on in the sangria as well. So real simple for 4th of July. You can do it up real cheap. You're not going to want to buy more than a pint, if a pint, of the alcohol, the straight up liquor that you're putting in there, whether it's the peach tree, the whiskey, whatever it is, at most you want a pint, because you got to remember you're putting wine in there, which is already going to be anywhere from 9 to 12%, depending on what it's going to be. And then as soon as you add that liquor mix, it's going to shoot it up there, and you don't want people driving home completely sloshed.
Forgetting that you restaged the entire plot of Independence Day in your underwear.
Speaking of Independence Day, so we're gonna transition
great segues
out of our
tonight. Folks.
I know, right? We're on top of it. Right into our movie reviews. And Nathan, you went and saw Independence Day over the weekend. So tell us what you thought.
Yes, Independence Day Resurgence. So I saw it with my wife, and we actually they didn't screen it for critics. Surprise, surprise. And so we checked it out. I have to say that my viewing of this was colored a little bit by the fact that we saw it at an Alamo Draft House. I don't know if anybody here knows what that is, but Alamo Draft House is our theaters. It started springing up in Texas initially, and they were theaters that, in addition to playing movies, they would set up where it was almost more of a dinner theater atmosphere where you would have a bar area in front of you. You'd have your theater seat. You'd be in the theater, but you could order food, like real food, burgers, salads, things like that. I mean, it's not just like an expanded theater food menu. It's a legitimate like food, pub food, if you will, and lots of draft beers and drinks and things like that. I had a Maker's Mark milkshake in my hand while I was watching this movie. And theater,
he thought it was the best movie he ever saw.
Yes,
folks.
Five stars. And where we were seated, the way the theater set up, we were in the second row, but the theater seats are about 4 or 5 feet back, even in the first row. It's also, they have a good policy about if you see anybody on your cell phone or anything like that, they give you one warning, and after that, you're kicked out, you're not coming back. Mm-hmm. You may not come back the next day.
Right.
And so that made the whole experience much nicer. So I'll say that going in. I did enjoy the original 95 or 96, rather, Independence Day. I thought it was a fun little disaster movie. We've seen it copied time and time again since then.
Yeah.
So this one was just Roland Emmerich coming in, and I noted while talking to Jen after the movie, I haven't liked a Roland Emmerich movie since Independence Day. I mean, he's done Godzilla, The Patriot, The Day After Tomorrow, the 2012,
yeah,
movies like that. I did White House Down. I didn't enjoy any of them. I know they were supposed to be big, dumb blockbusters, but I just didn't get into them. This one brings back the same story 20 years later. We have some of the same returning cast. We have Jeff Goldblum, mm-hmm, which was my sole reason for going to see this. And Goldblum's not in as much of the movie as you would imagine him to be. He's in a good bit of it, but the movie is so bloated. It's 2 hours long, which is not as long as the first movie,
right,
but it feels longer. They have so many characters. They bring back Bill Pullman, who played the president in the first movie, and here he's kind of a crazy oddball nutcase who's been touched by his experience with the aliens. Brent Spiner had that small role. He's mostly known for Data on Star Trek The,
yes,
Next Generation. He had that small role as Professor Oaken in the first movie where he was a crazy mad scientist and he was sort of taken out of the story pretty quickly. He returns here. I wasn't actually sure he was still alive, but he comes back. He wakes up out of his coma that he was in when the aliens came the first time, and now we have the aliens coming back. I won't get into much of the plot as much to the point that I understood it, but you have the aliens come back. They're bigger and stronger before. There's bigger destruction scenes. I mean, you know, Goldblum saying lines like, they like to get the landmarks, you know, and you're seeing things being destroyed on a great level. They bring some characters back that don't even really have a reason to be here, like Judd Hirsch playing Jeff Goldblum's father. He's in a completely separate storyline, and nothing much interesting happens. A lot of the special effects scenes are impressive, but a lot of the storyline ideas that were interesting aren't followed through on. One of the most interesting is the fact that 20 years after we had the first invasion, we've been retrofitting all their weaponry to build a defense system. So we have a defense system on the moon. We have lasers. We have spaceship technology based off of what the aliens gave us. That whole idea and how it affected the society is glossed over almost completely. We have it. We see the defense systems and some of the spaceships, and they're cool, but it doesn't really go into how it affected humanity in general. And it's weird because you have this branching alternative history that's going on. You think of all the changes that happened technologically to us in our world between 96 and 2016. You don't really see the effect it's had on the human race, except for, oh, we have some shiny new toys. That's about it. Mm. So don't go into that. A very interesting side plot, the potential side plot, was one of the spaceships didn't crash. It had actually landed. The aliens run out. They don't have the manpower to take over the planet, but they cause a lot of ruckus in this African village area where this warlord and his people have been fighting this thing for like the last 15 years, fighting the aliens, hand-to-hand combat with machetes and stuff. You have echoes of that story, but you don't see it. And I was thinking, that'd be a great, interesting story. There's potentially another race involved in this movie, and there's some other stuff involving how they come into the storyline. I don't want to get into that at all, but again, we're told a lot without being shown a lot. Mm. We have another case of stuff being held back for a sequel that I'm not sure will even happen at this point.
Yeah.
That being said, the movie's not terrible. I know that I rag on a lot of these movies and say they aren't up to snuff. You really shouldn't bother seeing them. This is another nostalgia picture. Roland Emmerich is hitting a lot of the same big dumb notes. I liked seeing Jeff Goldblum doing his weird Goldblumisms. They're a little forced this time, but they're there. I liked seeing Brent Spiner running around as if he had almost a starring role in the movie. I was not intrigued at all with all the new characters. All the returning characters are interesting to me, but not the young characters. Will Smith's not in this movie. His charisma that he had in the first movie, that's lacking. There's no one who replicates that here. I loved his interaction with Goldblum in the first movie. Yes. It's kind of what made it. And that's not here. There's not even – the scenes don't make kind of same logical sense. In Independence Day, we had a lot of storylines. They were generic, yes, but they all led to the same place.
Yes.
Storylines here just appear and disappear, and they go and they come. And you have a female president. It's like, oh, wow, that's progress. But then, you know, eventually she disappears and we have a male president come in and say, you know, save the day. And right. So every time they try to do something progressive, and they try that a couple times, it just feels half-hearted. The alien special effects are fun. There's a giant kind of queen alien, which you see in the trailers. That's a lot of fun. It has moments of entertainment. It's very breezy. When it's over, you will not remember it. Mm. People are not going to be quoting it. People aren't going to be applauding it, I think, when it's over. It's sort of there. It's not bad fun if you enjoyed the first movie. I'd say go see it at a matinee. If you can see it at an Alamo Draft House, even better. And if you can see it with a Maker's Mark milkshake in your hand,
even
more
better.
Power to you.
Let me ask you this, Nathan, about the movie. Did you see it in 3D or not?
No 3D.
No 3D. Let me just ask, just guessing on what you saw from it, do you think the 3D experience would be enhancing or not to the movie? Was there anything in there that might make 3D a worthwhile option for this movie?
Yeah, I mean, you have a lot of buildings falling up in the air and falling back down. And that stuff, if you enjoy that kind of thing in 3D, is nice. I will say my big thing with movies being in 3D, lots of times it reduces the clarity, I feel like. Seeing this movie at the Draft House and the print that we did and the way that we saw it, there was something to it that I enjoyed about seeing it in 2D. It almost harkened back to seeing the original Independence Day. One of the things I enjoyed about the original Independence Day, the aliens, when they showed up, the aliens themselves weren't in the movie very much. And they were practical effects mostly, you know, which is something almost unheard of in these days. You know, you think back to the alien biosuits were practical effects. The little alien inside were practical effects. None of those are practical effects anymore. And I feel like 3D, all it does is increase that sense of artificiality. So the scenes I enjoyed, the giant alien queen, even though that might be intriguing in 3D, I felt it was just more satisfying to look at in the 2D. I felt like the action was more crisp. The action was more easy to follow.
Sure.
I can't truly compare them because I didn't see this particular movie in 3D, but there's so much going on screen. I think you're better to – and it honestly, it's not worth the extra ticket price because at the end of the day, you just got a few more bells and whistles.
Right. Cool. Very cool. So one of the movies that I saw this weekend, we were trying to decide what to go see. Joy and I were huge fans of Now You See Me, and so we actually, I decided to go. It was her, it was me, Joy's father, and her brother. It was kind of a boys' night out. We went and saw Now You See Me 2. Really enjoyed this movie. It was such a fun movie. Had echoes of the first one going on in it. It advanced the plot and storyline of the first one. You find out more specifically about what happens to his dad, Mark Ruffalo's character, his father. We actually, our very first scene shoots back 20 or 30 years to that event. And so we see what actually goes on with his father being put in the safe and his father being dropped in the water and him not coming up. So that actually starts off our story. We pick up with Morgan Freeman in prison and, you know, wanting his revenge on the horsemen. There are some nice little plot twists like the first one had. I won't say they're as surprising. The Mark Ruffalo twist in the first one for me didn't come until the actual jail scene. That's when I figured out that he was the fifth horseman. These I felt like came much earlier, but they were still fun to go through and explore. One of my favorite scenes is one that's a sleight of hand done with all four of the horsemen. It's done in this bank security vault and they're trying to hide something and get it past guards. And so there's this sleight of hand going on with these cards. with the guards. That's really cool to watch, and it's probably the highlight of the movie. I think, Nathan, you were saying that that's kind of a scene that everyone had been talking about, that you had known about too, correct?
Yeah, the couple people I've heard talk about it mention that particular scene and that they enjoyed the magic tricks. A question for you. How is Daniel Radcliffe? Because I feel like it's like stunt casting a little bit. He's in the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think to an extent it is. But we actually get to see a different side of Radcliffe than we did in Harry Potter. I haven't really seen much of
anything
else.
Not the dead
else.
Farting corpse side of
Radcliffe, exactly.
We'll talk about that later.
Swiss Army. No, this was actually – this was really great. Just gonna, you know, throw this out there. I am going to give some spoilers. So
you already spoiled the first movie.
I know, right? For those of you who aren't interested in hearing the spoilers, go ahead and tune out. But we see Radcliffe coming on as the son of Michael Caine, and he takes up his arrogant father's persona, and he does a very good job of it. You could picture him as Michael's son's Caine in this movie.
Michael Caine's son.
Michael Caine's son, thank you. You know, backwards talking I am.
Thank you, Jim Beam.
That's right. but I just really enjoyed it. I thought they did a good job with the magic tricks. They were really fun to watch. A lot of them were practical magic tricks that you would expect someone to do. To me, it was slightly disappointing that they did the reveal of the magic tricks, but my father-in-law and I were talking before we went to the movie, and he was saying, now, you know, I mean, because it's a dangerous thing for magicians to reveal tricks. I mean, people will get killed for this stuff. But what I was telling him was that for the sake of a greater trick, a magician will reveal what's going on. And that's what you see happening in this movie. For the sake of greater tricks going on, they explain how these things are done. And that's what they did in the first one. There were the reveals because there was something bigger coming out. And so they're willing to show their hand, saying, you know what, people probably already know how this is done. This is old hat. I'm going to do this. And while you're focused on this trick that I'm showing you and revealing to you, I'm going to be pulling off another trick that you don't know is coming. And that's what you have going on here. But still really fun to watch. It does leave us with more of a sense of a sequel coming on than the first one did. And I think that's just something that we're seeing in movies today is the setup and the build for the return.
Yeah, but they don't keep an ending for themselves a lot of times in the movie that they're making.
They don't.
You know,
right.
That
yes.
It's not a satisfying experience in and of itself.
Right. And I think that's what the first one did very well that this one does not. The first one, I felt like if I never saw a sequel to it, I could enjoy that movie as a standalone. This one, you're left really wondering what's coming next without the sense of I mean, there is some closure to some of what's going on, but there is still a suspense moment going on of, all right, when are they bringing out the third one? And so to me, that was slightly disappointing that they weren't able to wrap up and tie up all those loose ends in that regard. But again, overall, you know, if Independence Day wasn't your thing, I would say go check out Now You See Me Too. Definitely worth it. And now we come to our third movie, which is kind of our highlight movie, Tarzan. And Rachel, you actually went to see this one with Nathan, didn't you? So we're going to go ahead and let you start off. Your thoughts on Tarzan.
Okay, so I read the books, mostly recently read the first one. And so I was more up to date when I heard that they were doing the movie. I reread that. I was excited when I first heard that they were doing Tarzan, and then when I saw the preview, I was really expecting to hate it, so much so that when Nathan almost canceled going to screening, I was like, okay. I had low expectations for it just because I thought maybe they just went into making a blockbuster as opposed to trying to tell a Tarzan story. And like, to be fair, you know, typically I'm a person, I like things when they stick to the books. But to be fair, Tarzan's not really a book that's supposed to be taken super serious. It's just a fun adventure tale. This one, so we went and saw it last night. And I wasn't sure how I felt about it when it first finished. I was like, I definitely didn't hate it. It was better than I thought it was going to be. And then now today, thinking back, I really enjoyed it. But that's coming from somebody who read the book, had expectations, and, you know, went through all of that. I might have known if I just had more of a plain, straight watching of it. I thought it was very enjoyable. It harkened back to, had certain qualities of late 90s films, I mm-hmm. thought. Had some slapstick with it, but it wasn't overdone, and it wasn't misplaced, and it wasn't too over the top. It provided, like, comic relief from time to time. Samuel L. Jackson, I was really worried about him, but kind of being in there just being the same character he is in Pulp Fiction, but they actually gave him a character, and he played it well. And I think there were things originally I thought that I would dislike about it, but all in all, it was, to me, a really fun movie. It was enjoyable, and I thought that they did well with the story. Some of the things that they changed to make it fit into a movie, and I thought it was done really well. I would actually go back and watch this again at the theater. I would pay money to go see this.
Nathan?
I'd like to say up front, they screened this for us with no 3D.
Yes.
I think it made a huge improvement on the viewing. Like Rachel, I enjoy Tarzan as a character. I mean, he had so much. He was a character before there were movies, you know, and mm-hmm. almost from the earliest times we had Tarzan or Tarzan-esque movies. But to be fair, he really hasn't had a great shake on the big screen. I mean, a lot of the Johnny Weissmuller movies, you either know those. There's probably he was a really athletic, you know, yeah. Olympian Tarzan, and there were tons of those movies. And then you had the really bad Bo Derek, Miles O'Keefe,
yes.
Tarzan the Ape Man, which was, you know, not a movie that should be really I would recommend at all.
Yeah.
They had a great one with Christopher Lambert from Highlander, played Tarzan and Greystoke, mm-hmm. the Legend of Tarzan. And that movie took a more kind of stately, more slow, realistic pace to the Tarzan story. It wasn't the swashbuckling that we're familiar with. So, and then, of course, you had the Disney film, and right. then you had the Casper Van Dien, like Tarzan in a Lost
yes,
City, which
yes.
is the most bottom of the barrel of Tarzan movies, I suspect. I'm sure someone will tell me that there's one even worse out there. But so this one comes at a point when, do we really need another Tarzan movie? And of course, with Edgar Rice Burroughs writing this story, you know, Tarzan is the great white, like, Avenger who is in the jungle killing apes and Africans. And, you know, it's almost like a poster boy for eugenics. And so to take a story like that, and it seems like a lot of people are focusing on, why do we have this Tarzan story now? And I think they're being a little, you know, they're focusing on that and not what the movie is or isn't. And so this is directed by David Yates, who he picked up the Harry Potter series
yes.
about
yep.
midway through, and then he finished it out. And I thought he did a really nice job with those. And here, Rachel nailed it when she said it's a reminiscent of late 90s movies. And a lot of the late 90s movies I'm thinking of are like The Mask of Zorro, mm-hmm. The 94 version of The Jungle Book that Stephen Sommers did. He also did The Mummy. That's a movie yep. this is very similar to. The Phantom. I could go on and on. Congo. Those movies are silly, kind of trash, a lot of them.
Yeah.
But they were enjoyable. They had a sense yes. of fun. The Rocketeer. I could probably sit here and just go through different titles. And there is a sensibility of that in this Tarzan movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll say this about this Tarzan movie. It's better written than those movies.
Definitely.
There's a story here, and knowing that Tarzan is a difficult property given the things I just mentioned, they do an interesting job of tying it to historical, when King Leopold comes in and sort of mines the Congo
mm-hmm.
and is, you know, they do a little bit of a revisionist history. There's a weird sense because Samuel Jackson is this movie. Christoph Waltz is the villain. And there is a sense of almost a little bit of the Tarantino revisionist history approach
sure.
melded with the silly, dumb, like, action-adventure story.
Yeah.
And that was tried a few years ago with The Lone Ranger. For me, The Lone Ranger failed in that. It felt like too many pieces all wound up.
Yeah.
There were 90 minutes of a good, rousing swashbuckler in The Lone Ranger, but it was lost in this very long, confused movie. Legend of Tarzan moves very briskly through the story. It begins with Tarzan, who is Lord Clayton of Greystoke. He's mm-hmm. in London. He's a celebrity. People even know things like, I'm Tarzan, you're Jane, you know. Jane is Margot Robbie in this movie. She's going to be in the Suicide Squad. She's going
yes.
to play Harley Quinn. And I'm really excited for that. Here, she's very modern. You think they're going to throw in the damsel in distress mode, but she holds her own.
Mm-hmm.
She has a lot of weird quips with Christoph Waltz. There is a little bit too much of a modern sensibility on this, but the old fashioned movie making is very evident here. The sets are great. I don't know quite where the $180 million or whatever it is they spent on this thing went, because it's not always evident in some of the special effects. The apes look terrific. Some of the other animal effects are a little dodgy. It's not that they're not good, but they're not up to the snuff of the Jungle Book. And it's also sad because there are great African vistas in this movie, but you don't see any real animals. They're all CGI. Mm-hmm. They look very good and convincing in a sense, but they're just not real.
Sure.
And that hurts a little bit. Alexander Skarsgård is a little more real as Tarzan. He's very chiseled and buff. But what I appreciate about that, his buffness is more of a, like, again, an athlete's physique. It's not a bodybuilder's physique. Yeah. We've seen bodybuilders be Tarzan. It's like you couldn't swing off of a swing off of a vine. It would snap. So his physique is unique to what it would be for a man growing up in the jungle. And they actually make mention, and they use special effects to show his knuckles are farther apart because he's been walking on them.
Yeah.
They use a lot of little details like that. Samuel L. Jackson actually really elevates the movie. Mm-hmm. He plays a character named George Washington Williams, who mm-hmm. is a neat – this is where you almost get the Tarantino vibe, because he is this agent for the U.S. government who was previously a mercenary that was aiding in the – I don't want to get into too many spoilers, but he has a whole past story they get into.
Yeah.
And now he's a U.S. Agent that is infiltrating some of these foreign countries and discovering where there's slavery and trying to weed it out. So he's mm-hmm. he's not just a sidekick to Tarzan. He's the guy who gets Tarzan back to the jungle. And when he's there, he's with him through the whole movie. He's a really interesting character. And Jackson's playing him like a slightly kinder, gentler version of the character he just played in The Hateful Eight. So there's a real guy there. And Tarzan mm-hmm. doesn't say a lot. He doesn't have a lot of dialogue. But Skarsgård has the stoicness down. He captures that well. The action scenes are a lot of fun. There's jumps off of trains and battles with apes. And there's a scene with wildebeest stampeding down. Everything's handled well. I liked the script. I thought it created a good story. It's just a kind of fun. It's not an amazing movie. It has flaws. But in that, I was carried through in the same spirit of the movies I mentioned. In fact, some of the things that aren't great about it are also the things you think back and are kind of amused by. Some of the quips and some of the modernity, but
the book. You know, if anyone who was a fan of the books, they're kind of the same way. It's like you don't finish that and think, man, that was a great novel, because it is, as you said, like pulpy. But you're like, that was a fun read. And I enjoyed the story and I got caught up in it. And I feel like the movie is that way. You're like, that wasn't like a great masterpiece, but it was fun.
And there were some amazing shots, too.
Yes,
the way
very
that
much.
Yates shows some of the tribes and everything, and creating a sense of Tarzan really is an anti-colonialist, which is a little different than you would expect. Mm-hmm. And so those things are all pretty neat. I think there's enough in there that it gets you through for a fun time at the theater. In fact, I don't have a lot of reservations about it. I'd say you go pay the full price, but see it at a matinee because it's in the spirit of a matinee, I think.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, great review of Tarzan, guys. Now, we said we were going to talk about BFG. We talked about it in – or we're going to talk about it next week, I should say. In that, we're going to have spoilers. So, if you don't want to listen to the spoilers, it is the last thing that we say on that one. So, you don't have to worry about, you know, when to stop it. We do tell you. But – we want to give a general review, and since all three of us saw it, let's go ahead and start talking about it. Who'd like to go ahead and just give the basic description? Nathan, Rachel is pointing to you. And
sure, why not? So the BFG is Steven Spielberg's new movie. We have been doing a whole series on Spielberg, which you can catch on the podcast. With episode, I think 12 or so, starts with Spielberg, and we do a four-part segment. And in this fourth part, we're going to discuss the BFG in more general terms. So we're just going to go through and give you a basic idea so you can know whether or not it's worth seeing this weekend. I think it really is. It's Spielberg's newest movie. It is a children family film. It's based off of the Roald Dahl book, same guy who did James and the Giant Peach, Matilda, and things of that nature. This is a really nice blending, from my perspective, of both Roald Dahl's sensibilities and Steven Spielberg's sensibilities.
Definitely.
Yes. You're going to get a movie that is very imaginative, but mm-hmm. also a little forlorn. There's a little bit of sadness, but not overdone. I took my 4-year-old son to see this, and I really don't regret it. He really got into it. The scarier elements didn't bother him too much. There are potentially child-eating giants in this storyline.
Yes.
There's a giant who is the BFG, played by Mark Rylance through motion capture special effects. Fantastic performance. One of the most fascinating and most compassionate, like, CGI characters I've ever seen in a movie, ever.
Yeah.
Probably
yeah.
fantastical character. One of the most emotive characters I've ever seen.
Very much.
And he's just so real and so there. And Ruby Barnhill, the little girl. Fantastic interaction between the two of them. Special effects are cool. There's a lot of neat scenes. And again, there's a sense of humor that establishes itself. I mm-hmm. said in the other podcast that this is the best use I've ever seen of a fart joke. So
yes.
I consider that a highest recommendation because I hate fart jokes.
Yes. Rachel?
This is a, like, it's weird to say that it's a fun one considering that it has heavier elements to it, but it's engaging. It's magical. You have Steven Spielberg, I think, coming back in great form, compared to some of, you know, other things that I've seen recently. It was good. It's good. It's fun. It's engaging. I would say go see it for definitely.
Yeah, and I agree 100% on the podcast that our audience will listen to next week. I comment a lot on Spielberg magic. He has a way of bringing a story to life. He has a way of engaging both adults and children in a childlike manner, and I believe this film brings those elements together in a truly great way. Mm-hmm. That combines both Roald Dahl's imagination and yet brings Steven Spielberg's unique spin and twist of bringing that story to life and showing us what it would be like in the land of giants.
Wonderful soundtrack by John Williams, too.
Yes.
And this movie doesn't require children. You can go see this as a child of all ages kind of movie.
Yep.
But I will say, if you have some children that will be interested in seeing it and they can handle it again, it's a PG kind of right down the center. Take them because it does enrich the experience. Particularly if you have a child sitting there during the fart scene, you'll know what I mean when it happens. Wonderful movie. I'd recommend it. The 3D was really nice, actually. I don't think it's necessary, but it was handled excellently.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that you and I tend to bring up a lot, Nathan, is does 3D enhance a movie or does it distract? And you're right, this enhances it. This is a movie that I'd be willing to pay full price to go see in the theaters. We have 4th of July coming up, Independence Day, which we talked about, and Now You See Me. This is one of those ones that even above
those –
blows
those out of the water.
I agree. I agree 100%.
The clarity isn't lost through the 3D either. It's retained. So
yes.
That's nice.
Absolutely. And so, Nathan, we have a few more minutes. Why don't you go ahead? You saw Swiss Army Man with Daniel Radcliffe. I gave you my thoughts on what he did. I thought he was really good in Now You See Me Too. Your thoughts on Swiss Army Man?
Yeah, so this is the one where Daniel Radcliffe plays Harry Farter. But so this it's really not an it's not an exaggeration. I mean, basically, Paul Dano is on this island alone. He's about to commit suicide because he's run out of all options. He doesn't think he's going to be rescued. He sees a body wash up on the shore. He finds the body. It almost instantly starts farting, and it doesn't stop farting for the entirety of the movie. And as he brings it along with him, it kind of comes back to life, seemingly so, and it starts to talk. And Daniel Radcliffe is the dead body. And as he starts to become reanimated, he doesn't really know a lot of things. He's forgotten everything. So Dano is teaching him everything all over again, including everything that Dano thinks he knows about the world and about pop culture. There's, in fact, a lot of really weird jokes involving Jurassic Park here. You will have a scene where Dano is dressed up trying to get Radcliffe to recognize that he is Laura Dern, and they reenact Jurassic Park, and they even sing some of it on the soundtrack. There's a lot of weird snippets of music that you recognize, pop culture fragments and whatnot popping up. The other element is that Paul Dano starts to use Radcliffe as a tool, a survival tool. That's where the Swiss Army Man part comes in.
Yes.
He actually uses him to like chop wood, and he propels him like a raft, motor-propelled, but in this case, flashlight propelled across the surface of the water. This is a weird movie that is just gobs of stuff stuck together. Mm-hmm. When you see the movie, it's hard for me to recommend it. It is a weird movie. Its weirdness is its primary drawing factor. It hints at a few times at being existential and being about a person trying to discover the purpose of their life and what makes us a person and how different is that person from, say, an animal. But all of that is kind of – the first thought was, let's make a movie about a farting corpse. And then the second thought was, let's add some thoughtfulness to it. The thoughtfulness is not really doing it for me in this movie. The movie's strange, but the experience of watching it is a thing. I don't think you're going to go back to this movie. I don't think anyone's going to go back to this movie after they watch it once.
I still wish I could unseen the preview.
Well, but there's a morbid fascination in that preview. Dano and Radcliffe are having so much fun. The simple fact that someone was harebrained enough to make this up is going to work for some people. It kind of works for me. I have to say that the simple fact that it exists is almost a win for them. There are going to be people that are going to go see this because they're tired of everything that's in the multiplex, and they want to see something a little quirky. My concern is it's too quirky, and it fades and it evaporates, much like a blast of flatulence, the moment, you know, it's kind of potent for a few minutes. But after that... it's time for us to wrap up. But I'm saying this, if your thing is strange movies, Swiss Army Man might do it for you. There are people out there I know are going to love this movie, but there's people also know that are into this sort of thing that are going to see this and just see it as a weird collection of gags. Yeah. So I don't think it's a pay money to see at the theater kind of movie. Mm. This is going to be those Netflix things you turn on at 2 a.m. when you're sick and you just can't unwatch it. So I guess a recommendation... I guess.
Yeah. All right. Fair enough.
Radcliffe was fun. It was a lot of fun to see him do that.
All right. Well, there you go. So Netflix watch, I mean, maybe in light of all the movies that we discussed on this episode, not one you want to go see in theaters. But hey, for some of you, maybe it's your cup of tea. And
just
want
to relieve yourself of the summer blockbuster.
Such a horrible joke. Well, we are winding down on time. We want to just kind of make this one a little shorter. But before we head out, Nathan, we have chosen the four books that we want to put out there for our poll. And so I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about those a little bit and get us excited about what's coming up for our reading discussion.
Sure. So what we had talked about in the past, and we really want to kind of jump on and have our first kind of episode of this, is doing a book club. We're going to try to run that through Goodreads. I said last week, but I will have stuff up tonight discussing how we're going to do this. We'll start sort of a group in Goodreads so we can discuss it. Going to basically put out four titles. We're going to choose one, though certainly you are welcome to read and comment on any of them. But we're going to choose one. Nathan and I are going to read it. Mm-hmm. All the listeners are welcome to read as well. And then what we will do, as we have discussions, we will participate in the discussions too, but we'll come back and do a whole podcast on the specific book we choose. Yeah. I have four choices for us. We're going to pick one of these through a poll that you'll be able to actually help choose. I'll put it on Facebook and we'll basically tally up all the answers, and the one that we pick, we'll be discussing that one primarily. But again, feel free to read or comment on any of them. So the four that we have, try to pick a little bit of a theme. And what I want to do for our first one is not have something that was such a big undertaking, something we could do before the end of the summer and kind of get the podcast in, hopefully by like the end of August or something. So I have four choices. They are in the, probably I would say, the young adult vein, mm-hmm. and kind of the fantasy sci-fi, if you will. Not so much science fiction, but four books I thought were very good. They are shorter books, so this is not a huge commitment we're talking about in terms of reading. We have four choices. The first one, I wanted to go with something kind of classic that I haven't read for a very long time, but that I remember loving, which is Ray Bradbury's Dandelion Wine. If anyone's familiar with Ray Bradbury, you know he did Fahrenheit 451. We've talked about him on the podcast before. Did the Martian Chronicles. Great. Just one of the forefathers of like what we consider modern science fiction. Dandelion Wine is not science fiction. It's really almost a magical realist memoir of his growing up in Greentown, Illinois. It is his childhood. And the story, it's just a really neat, evocative tale of growing up over a summer. You know, when you were a kid and those summers, it never ended. And it brings in lots of different storylines, lots of different perspectives. It's just it's a wonderful read. So that's one of the choices. If you haven't read that, I can't say enough good things about Dandelion Wine. Second book is called Railsea by China Melville. Melville's a writer who has a magnificent imagination. His books are very, very strange. He usually writes books that are really large and in the vein of adult novels a lot of times. Embassy Town, fantastic sci-fi novel, City Within a City. Railsea is interesting because it really harkens back to Herman Melville, the author of Moby Dick. This is essentially Moby Dick in a kind of futuristic, kind of post-apocalyptic world where now everyone is riding trains across great vast prairies and they're hunting giant, enormous, like whale-sized mole rats that are burrowing up through the ground. They call them like Moldywarps. And so they have fashioned all these kind of like steampunk-esque battleships that are trains, but set up like actual like whaling vessels, and they travel across these, and they're trying to figure out, there's a young character who's trying to figure out, where does the rail sea end and what is beyond the rail sea once you get beyond it? So a lot of those elements we're familiar with stories like Maze Runner and stuff, but Melville brings a real imagination to it, and it is a really neat twist on Moby Dick without just copying that story over again. So really recommend that one a lot. Then I picked two that are coming, that are turning into movies soon, because it'll be interesting to be able to read these, discuss them, discuss their themes, and then see what happens when they become movies. One of those is Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
Yep.
Haven't read the book. I'm hearing good things about it. There's a Tim Burton movie coming out in the fall. Mm-hmm. So I thought this would be an interesting one, that if we pick it, we can kind of be able to dissect and see what's there as a story, how it translates to the screen. Then finally, there is A Monster Calls. And this is a book that it's going to be a little different, I think, than the other choices, because there's a really a sense of melancholy to this. We just recently did a review of the BFG, which is based off a very like cheerful Roald Dahl story. This is a much darker version, almost, of that, of a similar story, where you have a young boy. His mother is ill, terminally ill, and there's a monster that comes to him in the middle of the night, and it's coming to him for a specific reason. We kind of find what that reason is as the story continues. That has a lot of potential, too. And it's being made into a movie with Liam Neeson is going to be the voice of the monster. You can see the trailer online. It looks like a very interesting but dark story. So those are the four. I'm going to put them up with a little bit more description. Mm-hmm. They're all going to be worthwhile, I think. So whatever we pick, it's going to be a cool discussion. And then we'll really get into that and really try to just engage the listeners and get involved.
Cool.
Awesome. All right. We're going to go ahead and sign off now. Hope you all enjoyed.
Yeah. Happy 4th.
Really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wang?